Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Forbes magazine publisher and two-time Republican presidential hopeful Steve Forbes joins us now. He has a new book that argues for a return to the gold standard for the dollar. It's called Money: How the Destruction of the Dollar Threatens the Global Economy and What We Can Do About It. Mr. Forbes, thank you for coming in. Welcome to WNYC.
Good to be with you, Brian. Thank you.
So with all the economic issues that Americans do think about day to day, jobs, housing prices, wages, how the stock market's doing, why write a book about one that's not on most people's minds, the gold standard?
Precisely because that's a critical reason why we're in the mess we're in today and why we experience the stagnation of today. If you don't get the money right, then even if you get other things right, you're still going to have economic troubles. Money makes buying and selling easier. It simply makes transactions easier, much easier than barter. And money measures value. It's a measure of value the way scales measure weight, clocks measure time, and rulers measure length. And if you don't have a reliable measure of value, then you don't get the investment you normally would. And since we went off a gold standard in 1971, the average growth of the U.S. economy has been subpar historically. And if we had maintained the average growth rates we had up to 1971 through to today, our economy, astonishingly, would be 50% bigger than it is today. Over time, this thing hurts.
Now, this has become a liberal-conservative debate. So conservatives and libertarians like yourself, who want to weaken government power in general over markets, want a gold standard because you say the Federal Reserve can't control inflation through interest rates and other monetary policy. Liberals want government to retain that option. Is this about giving maximum power to market forces and weakening government for you?
No. Back in the 1880s, Germany was on a gold standard, but it invented the modern welfare state. Before World War I, the epicenter, Britain, of the gold standard, passed a significant amount of social legislation. All this makes sure is that you have a reliable measure of value. It makes economic growth easier because you get more productive investment. So what you do with the additional wealth, that's a political question, but it doesn't preclude a welfare state, a laissez-faire state. It just ensures that you have a reliable measure of value.
So I looked up opposition to gold standard to prep myself for this interview, since I'm no expert. And of course,
nor are the experts.
Some Paul Krugman articles came up, some columns. So he has argued, for example, that returning to a gold standard would be, in his words, a cosmically bad idea. And one reason he gives is that he says it's a myth that the gold standard is a hedge against inflation. He says inflation has actually been much lower and more stably low during the Bernanke era, with a supposedly inflationary easy money policy, than it was back in the days before Nixon left the gold standard, when we had plenty of wild swings despite it. Does he have a point?
No. Put aside how you measure the consumer price index, which is an ever-changing thing. In terms of what we went off, started to go off the rails again in the early part of the last decade, we had semi-stability in the 80s and 90s, gold averaged roughly about $350 an ounce. But in the early part of the last decade, under President Bush, government decided to adopt an easy dollar policy. And when that happens is you get distortions in investment. We had a housing bubble. That never would have happened if we had a stable dollar. Look at the price of gasoline 12 years ago, $1 a gallon. Today, $3, $4, $5, depending on what part of the country you're in. You go to the supermarket today. Look at median incomes. Median incomes do not grow, or they usually stagnate when you don't have stable money. And so the middle class feels that it's under pressure. So this thing is not just in terms of economics. This is about what we call in a book, we have a chapter on it, social trust.
But in general, Krugman argues that a gold standard would hurt middle class wages because it would be deflationary for various reasons. One is that the price of gold would be fixed at a much lower price than it's going for on the market right now, and that would cause deflationary pressure on wages, which, as you agree, are already stagnating. So does he have a point about that?
No, because it depends on what you set the price at. In the 1920s, for example, when Britain returned to a gold standard, it badly mispriced it and got an unnecessary deflation. We did not make that mistake after World War II, so we had a boom in the 50s and 60s. And this, that's one of the myths we deal with in the book. Gold is simply a dollar related to gold, simply a fixed measure of value, like 60 minutes in an hour. That's not inflationary, deflationary.
But 60 minutes in an hour is kind of, well, I guess humans define what an hour is, so it's not like natural law. But it's the government, ironically, that would set the price of gold, right?
And related to the marketplace.
Related to the dollar. So it was $20 an ounce, I think, back in the pre-Depression era.
An ounce. Then Roosevelt devalued the dollar, didn't do much good during the Depression.
That made it $35
an hour.
Dollars an ounce.
But he kept it fixed to gold.
And it persisted like that until Nixon ended it in the 70s. But I'm not sure that I get that. So why would the price of a commodity like gold be set by the government to not fluctuate with the market over a 40-year period?
You're not setting the price of gold. What you're doing is setting the value of your currency, fixing it. When you see fluctuations in the price of gold, that's not about the intrinsic value of gold. That says more about people's perceptions of the particular currencies. 3 years ago, people really thought we were going off the cliff again,
right?
Deficit problems.
Right.
Debts and all that kind of thing. So gold surged up. That was a fear about the dollar. You saw the same thing in 1980 when you had a surge.
So how would that stabilize the dollar? Because the price of gold today is about $1,250 an ounce.
But again,
it had surged to about $1,800, I believe, at the depths of the financial crisis. So wouldn't that have devalued the dollar? As you're concerned Bernanke's easy money policy is devaluing the dollar?
No. Gold has a fixed value. It's the one thing that fluctuates less in intrinsic value than anything else. Not perfect, but better than anything else. One, you can't destroy it. Every ounce that's been mined is still with us today. If you have a gold ring, there are probably some grams going back to Pharaoh times. But so gold has a fixed value. What you do is you want to make sure the currency has a fixed value, not set by whims of the government. And so you try to get a price that reflects current market conditions. So let's call it $1,200 or $1,300 today. All that would mean is if it started to go above $1,300, stop creating money, goes below $1,300, create more money. And when we've been on a gold standard, when Britain went on it to back in the 1700s, for all the ups and downs, you have a much higher standard of living when you have stable money, just as you have a much ability to do more transactions when you know when you buy a pound of cheese, it's 16 ounces in the pound. It doesn't float each day.
And critics also say in today's global economy with all the different currencies, there isn't enough gold out there to underpin all the paper currencies anyway, so this is unworkable or really at least very expensive to mine a lot more gold.
We deal with these myths in the book. And you don't need 1 ounce of gold to own it by the government. Again, you just pick the market, have that market price, and take it off from there.
You don't need gold to peg the dollar to gold?
You don't need to own it, no. That you just need to keep it within that fixed price range.
What would you fix it at today? Today, what would you fix it at?
I'd go by the marketplace. It's if you announce that you're going to do it, part of the price of gold today still reflects fears about the dollar. So it'll probably be in the range of $1,000 to $1,200. You don't want it too low. You don't want it too high. But if you get it in the right range, you'll be fine.
So I'm even more confused because if you say that it would fluctuate with the dollar, people already, as they lose confidence in the dollar, can sell dollars and buy gold.
Yeah, and that's the whole point of a gold standard. If you don't trust the currency, you turn it into the government, and the government knows that it's got a problem. You wouldn't own gold unless you're a jeweler, unless you fear about what's going to happen to the dollar, to a currency, because it's not like building a factory. You don't earn interest on it, although you can't earn interest on anything thanks to the Federal Reserve. But so you normally wouldn't hold gold except as an insurance policy unless you fear and see that it's what's happening in the marketplace.
Steve Forbes, my guest on WNYC, his new book is Money, How the Destruction of the Dollar Threatens the Global Economy and What We Can Do About It. It's basically an argument for a return to the gold standard. Let me go bigger and ask you a philosophical question.
Mm-hmm.
What's an economy for? That's a serious question. What is the purpose of choosing any economic system over any other?
Economy is people trading with each other, transactions, enabling to get a higher standard of living. You want to put things together or you want to offer your labor. And barter is highly inefficient. That's why money was invented. Coins in Lydia, in Athens, 2,600 years ago. One of the points we make in the book, money is a measure of value. It communicates the value of various things in the marketplace. It makes transactions easier. You don't have to worry if you've got the right number of sheep to buy certain amounts of chickens. You can make those choices much, much easier. So money makes the transactions easier. Money has no intrinsic value.
Well, that's what money is for. That's what currency is for.
And you get more productive transactions when you don't have to worry about the value of the the value of the money. Money reflects value. You've got to fix that, like 16 ounces in a pound, and off you go.
Well, I'm trying to go bigger here into what an economy is for. And I guess I was
economy enables people to do things with one another, cooperate with one another, break barriers with one another. When you have money, it breaks barriers with strangers because I don't have to know you to do a transaction with you. And so all the raps about money are actually quite the opposite. You may not love your neighbor, but you sure want to sell to your neighbor.
Let me ask you a question about libertarian economics. Would you call yourself a libertarian?
Free market economics.
Free market.
Whatever label you want to give to it.
What I wonder if we should consider many of the free market economists today kind of utopians. Because on the other side, the real Marxists were utopian, thinking government could mandate everything and have it work out for the masses. The Soviet Union taught us where that leads. But free market utopian that we hear, it seems to me we hear in the media a lot today, is this sort of supernatural belief in the power of markets to take care of everything. But don't sometimes pure markets work for the national interest, the common good, helping people support their families? Sometimes they don't. Sometimes supply and demand works for the interest of the few, not the many, in fundamental ways. And it's right for civil society, for democracy, to smooth it out. I'm not talking about the welfare state. I'm talking about intervention in the economy. Would you put it that way?
Well, free markets, remember, are people. It's not some amorphous thing out there. It's people buying and selling each day, making choices each day, doing things each day. And in terms, is it perfect, free markets? No, because people are not perfect. James Madison was right. He said, if we were angels, we'd not need government, we'd not need laws. Manifestly, we are not angels. So you do need rules of the road. But it's one thing for a government to say, don't drive 100 miles an hour in a school zone, quite another for the government to tell you what to drive, where to drive, and how to drive. And so markets are always, when allowed to operate, people will always turn scarcity into abundance. Just take what we used to call cell phones 30 years ago, big as a shoebox, 40-minute battery life.
But that's the utopian thinking, isn't it?
Not utopian.
People will always.
Look what happened 30 years ago.
You said people will always turn scarcity into abundance.
When allowed to do so. And we're going to see it in healthcare. A new healthcare system is emerging. But take those cell phones, $3,995 30 years ago, billions around the world today. 110 years ago, Henry Ford turned a toy for the rich, something that cost the equivalent of over $120,000. Moving assembly line turned a toy for the rich into something every working person could afford.
But let's
always turn scarcity into abundance if permitted to do so.
Or sometimes, let's take wages for an example. Markets these days have top executive wages growing steadily while average worker wages stagnate. The ratio, you know this, between CEO wages and average wages is staggering compared to the past. And the market doesn't give enough hardworking people enough of the share of the growth that is actually taking place. They're not rewarded enough for their productivity. The CEOs are rewarded too much, as many people see it today. That's the market not working in America.
The market,
do you disagree?
I disagree in the sense that markets are not working because the government's not letting them work. When you have a tax code that no one understands, you have hundreds of thousands of people making their living on something incomprehensible, brain power wasted. That's a drag on the economy. When you have unstable money, history shows time and time again, you get less economic growth,
that's
less
why,
rise
that's
in wages.
That's why we have
– And look at what's happened with Obamacare. Huge uncertainty, especially for small and new businesses, which are the job creators. Whenever you have stable money, a sensible tax code, wages go up. That's been the history of our country and the world.
So you're saying the tax code, which I think has mostly added the Bush tax cuts over the last 10 years, in that same period, we've seen middle-class wages stagnate while upper-class wages continue to grow with economic growth. That's where most of the growth has been distributed. So why shouldn't we think that the tax cuts of the last 10-plus years have been a redistribution of wealth upward?
Well, two things on that. One is if you look at what they love to call quintiles, you'll find that the individuals in those quintiles are constantly changing.
The top 20%, the bottom 20%.
Yeah, it's always in a state of flux.
But they're changing so less. Less in America than they were before? There's less social mobility, less statistical incidence of moving into a different quintile than you were born into than there was 50 years ago?
No, it worked very nicely until the early part of the last decade. Even the IRS did a study from 1995 to the middle part of the last decade and found that most people who start out in the bottom quintile, not only did their wages go up, but they went up a quintile or two. What's happened in the last 10 or 12 years, which started under George Bush, this is not a partisan thing. Clinton got it largely right on monetary policy. Reagan did. John Kennedy did. So it's not a partisan thing. But when you start to muck around with the money, as they did, and Keynes was right on this one, he said not one in a million will be able to diagnose what is happening when this destructive force is unleashed. And that's what's happened in the last 12 years. You have a chapter discussing more social divisions, 1% versus the 99, young versus old, 47% versus everybody else. And so you get this turning on one another because people sense they can't get ahead. You got more speculation. The link between, as Keynes pointed out, honest effort and reward seems to be severed or frayed. So the social fabric frays. So again, stable money is money works because of trust. A dollar bill has no intrinsic value. It's people's trust in it. And when that trust is undermined, it goes beyond economics. It goes to the whole social fabric.
But I'm going to throw one more counterexample at you. The New York City Wall Street economy. In recent years, Wall Street has been eliminating jobs while profits are growing for the core Wall Street firms. Maybe you'll credit Ben Bernanke for that and the easy money, which might be right.
Yes, it is.
But New York has higher unemployment in the finance sector despite those additional profits in the finance sector. Econ 101 says it's not supposed to work that way.
No.
In a free market.
In a free market, true free market. Put Wall Street aside just for 1 second. In a true free market, you're always finding ways to do things more efficiently. The agricultural economy today makes up less than 2% of the economy. It was once 70 or 80%. Railroads after World War II employed was one of the biggest employers in the country, 1.2 million. Today it's less than 200,000. We carry 10 times as much freight. That's productivity. But you always have these new and better jobs being created.
But isn't that the problem, that the new and better jobs aren't – let me just finish the question.
Sure.
That the new and better jobs aren't being created at a fast enough rate, that workers are being more
and
productive.
That begs
I think
the question.
American productivity is strong, but the wages are not keeping up with it. Because of globalization, because of automation.
Well, first, in terms of productivity, we're not getting the gains we normally would. But the key thing is, whenever you have this kind of wage stagnation, the economy's not growing the way it should, we normally should be growing at a 50% higher rate, is because of government policies. Again, when you have unstable money, you get less sustainable growth. That's been and so that's history. That's not theory. That's laboratory of the real world. When the government absorbs resources, where do those resources come from? They come from you through taxation, borrowing, or printing of money, which is another form of taxation. And then in terms of health care, when you have uncertainty about what a person's going to cost if you bring them on, and they're throwing exemptions in, taking exemptions away, that hurts it.
We'll save health care for another day, and I hope you'll come back. Steve Forbes, my guest for another couple of minutes, his new book, Money, How the Destruction of the Dollar Threatens the Global Economy and What We Can Do About It. A little current politics before
Sure.
you go. You ran for president twice in the Republican primaries in 1996 and 2000. The country seems to be trending away from Republican presidential aspirations, especially with the growing Latino populations in the South and West, who Republicans are not seen as representing the interests of. The defeat of Eric Cantor, partly over immigration reform, is seen as possibly another bad omen for Republican presidential candidates in 2016. How do you see that?
First, 2014, the Republicans are going to do well. They're going to take control of the Senate. Eric Cantor, that goes to the thing, never take your constituents for granted. He didn't do the homework. By contrast, in South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, who was even more trouble than Eric Cantor was over a host of issues that roused conservatives, he did his homework, did his constituency work, won in a landslide.
Did continue to support immigration reform.
And so it's not the issue. It's you got to also bring your constituents with you. Lindsey Graham did. Now, in 2016, you're going to see a host of candidates, including like Rand Paul, including good governors like Scott Walker, who know how to reach out, and just as Reagan did in the 1980s. Reagan, the oldest president we had, did very well among young people. Those demographics, in terms of how people vote, are constantly changing in American politics. Nothing is fixed, which was one reason why it's so exciting and exasperating.
Not you in 2016,
I'm an agitator.
Are you backing anyone? Or you mentioned a couple of names. do you have a few you're most interested in?
I'm looking at the field, because for once in the Republican Party, we don't have a true front runner. It's not my turn time, as we've had in the past. And so it's wide open, so it's going to be very exciting.
How much of a Chris Christie fan are you?
I think he's done a great job in New Jersey under very difficult circumstances. He's just got to get these investigations behind him by the end of 2014, and then he can take a serious look after the November elections.
And last thing, Congressman Kevin McCarthy is seen as the likely new majority leader, and I know I've heard him on very free market interview shows. So is he right in your free market wheelhouse, and will he try to move your gold standard forward?
This book will try to help educate Kevin McCarthy and others. And the key thing is for everyone to remember, money is a measure of value. And just like a clock is a measure of time. And if government tries to manipulate it, trouble results.
Steve Forbes, publisher. How's the magazine?
Media business is doing good. But I have to say the website is booming more than the print side.
Are you finding a way to monetize it? This is everybody's problem. More people are reading the New York Times content than ever before. But they can't monetize it in the way they did with the paper, for example.
You have to where the old model, which goes back to the 1830s with the invention of the steam press, has been shattered, and you got to do the whole thing. We've done a massive remodeling, and that's what you have to do in this new world.
Steve Forbes' book is called Money, How the Destruction of the Dollar Threatens the Global Economy and What We Can Do About It. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.